I was on my way to work, stuck in the usual traffic, listening to the radio, when I glanced out of the window and suddenly saw my life going the other way, sitting on the back of a lorry. I recognised it immediately. Even though I still hadn't lived most of it, it was definitely my life, and it was heading out of town, going against the grain of the morning rush hour. It's not the kind of life you can easily mistake. I'd been planning it for years. I knew it was mine from the shape of it, the wealth of opportunities in it, from the twinkle in its eye. It was my life, no doubt about it. My blood ran cold. I was gripped by panic. My life, I thought. It's been stolen by unscrupulous thieves. They've hijacked it. They'll probably re-spray it and sell it abroad to some rich, bored nobody who's wanted an interesting life for years. Not, I hasten to add, that my life was interesting. At least not at that time. On the contrary, it was very dull and routine. But the life ahead of me, my new life as an international traveller, a world-renowned wit and raconteur, as a film star, best-selling novelist, philanthropist, lover of beautiful women and family man, was a good one. And now it was fading from sight in my rear-view mirror. I couldn't just let it disappear like that. I could be late for one day. This was more important. A life was at stake. Mine. I did a U-turn in the road and gave chase. After a few minutes, I caught up with it. For a second, I thought that maybe they'd been trying to deliver it, and having found me not at home, were taking it back to the depot. But then I realized what a foolish thought this was. It had been stolen, no doubt about that. A few minutes later, we were on the motorway. My old car isn't in the best of health, not like the Ferrari I was due to have in the new life ahead, and I had trouble keeping up with the lorry. Suddenly, my car lost speed and steam came from under the bonnet. I had to pull over onto the hard shoulder and find a telephone. That was the last I saw of the lorry and of my wonderful life, the two of them vanishing over the horizon together, on their way to who knew where. I felt like crying. My beautiful life gone forever. I'd never get another one like it. I'd been dreaming of it for years, and I hadn't even remembered to take the lorry's number. Yes, I felt so bad I could have cried. The patrolman arrived and got me back on the road. But it was hopeless trying to catch the lorry, so I drove back into town and headed for the police station. On my way, I stopped to phone Miss Peasley at the office. "It's me, Miss Peasley," I said. "I'm sorry I'm going to be late. My life's been stolen. I saw it this morning on the back of a lorry."
"Life?" she said. "What life, Plumcott? I wasn't aware that you had a life, not to speak of. You've got your 9-to-5 here and your bicycle outings at the weekend, and that's about it, isn't it?"
"Yes, Miss Peasley," I conceded. "It may seem that way, although you shouldn't judge a man by his anorak. But I mean my other life. You know, the life I should have had as a film star and an international sportsman. It was obviously on its way to me, but it's been abducted. It might take me a while to get things sorted out. I'm just on my way to the police station to report the theft. I should be into the office by mid-morning at the latest." I hung up the phone and hurried off to the police station. "Good morning, Sergeant," I said. "I wish to report a theft as a matter of some urgency." He reached for a report sheet.
"Oh, yes, sir," he said. "And what property have you lost?"
"Had stolen," I reminded him. "Someone has stolen my life. I saw it this morning on a lorry. I tried to give chase, but lost it on the motorway."
"Your life, you say, sir? Someone's stolen your life? Are you sure you're not making this up, sir?"
"I know it sounds far-fetched," I said, "but it's true. A whole life. It's been taken from right under my nose."
"You'd better give us a full description then, sir, if you would. Now, this life of yours, exactly what did it look like?"
It took me 20 minutes to describe it all to him. The beauty of it, its depth, dimension, eventfulness. I told him about the deeds of heroism, the acts of charity, of the great loves, the life-saving inventions, the feats of superhuman endurance, the fame, the acclaim, the popularity, the dignified and painless end, the national day of mourning, the monument in St. Paul's. And then I told him how all my hair began to grow back and cover up the thin bit. When he had written it all down, the sergeant looked up from his notes and nodded.
"Yes, I can see now, sir, why someone would wish to get their hands on a life like that. Why, to hear you describe this life of yours, sir, it makes me wish I had one like it myself. But wouldn't you have been better keeping a valuable life like that under lock and key and under constant surveillance? Or putting it in a bank vault? It wasn't that easy, I explained. I didn't know it existed outside the realms of imagination. It was only this morning that I realised my life had a life, and now it's been stolen. That's the trouble these days, you see. Your life's not your own.
Well, we have a full description, sir. It doesn't look like the sort of life you can hide for long. As soon as it appears in public, we'll move in.
Thank you, I said. Thank you very much.
One thing, though, sir, he added as I turned to go.
Do you have any proof of ownership?
Proof of ownership?
The breath went from my body.
Yes. Are you able to establish beyond doubt, sir, that this magnificent life is indeed yours?
But of course it's mine. Who else has reported a life missing?
Well, nobody as yet, sir, but if you did have a receipt, it could go some way.
Of course I don't have a receipt, I snapped. I've worked for and dreamed of this life for years. I wanted a life like it all my life. I can assure you it's mine and no one else's. I was born for a life like it. You ask my mother.
The sergeant had to reluctantly admit that this more or less clinched it. And as there was nothing else to be done just then, I left my address and phone number and went into work.
So you got here at last, Plumcott?
Miss Peasley said as I arrived.
Any sign of that life of yours?
They're on the case, I told her. They're watching all the airports. They expect to have news very soon.
Well, it certainly is time you've got a life, Plumcott, she said. Even half a life will be better than that old threadbare thing you go around in now. It looks like you've got it out of a jumble sale. And off she went to the sandwich shop. But I'd show her. I'd show them all. Just as soon as I got my life. The next few days were a time of great stress and anxiety. At first, I rang the police station every few hours, but they said they'd call as soon as they heard anything. I went home and put the television news on, hoping that there might be an item on my life, a description of it and a reconstruction of the crime. But no, there was no mention of it at all. I presume the police had issued a media blackout, so as not to cause wholesale panic amongst the public by telling them that life stealers were on the loose. The next week, there was still no news, nor the week after. I rang the police station a few more times, only to be told that they were dealing with it, but that resources were overstretched and I wasn't the only crime victim in the world. But I can't pretend I wasn't worried. What if they never recovered my life? What if it had already left the country and was being dismantled and sold off in job lots? But then I got a phone call from the police station.
Mr. Plumcott, he said, can you come over, sir, to identify some property? We've recently recovered several stolen items in a raid on a local warehouse, sir, and have reason to believe that your life may be among them.
I'll be round immediately, I said.
When I arrived at the police station, the sergeant took me into a large room packed high with stolen property. He drew my attention to a wooden pallet covered with a tarpaulin. Under there, sir, he said, if you care to take a look. I stepped forward and pulled the tarpaulin back. Imagine my disappointment. It was a poor and shabby life, not mine at all. It was one of those mundane, mass-produced things that you see every day. It was a stand-in-line life, a making-ends-meet life, a check-in-the-post small overdraft life, full of headaches and migraines, crying babies and squabbling kids, small happiness and big woes. It was at least a stone overweight, and it combed its hair over its bald spot to make it look as though it didn't have one. It was a life of petty frustrations, unrealized ambitions and unattained ideals. It looked like the kind of life which had fallen off the back of a lorry, not the sort which had been loaded onto one.
Well, sir? The sergeant asked.
No, I shook my head. That's not it, I'm afraid.
And I left. The weeks turned to months. There was still no news of my life. I stopped ringing the police station and they never called again. Even Miss Peasley seemed to have forgotten all about it, and she stopped making remarks and began calling me Jim instead of Plumcott. It was a bad period for me, to have had the life you wanted almost within your grasp and then for it to vanish up the motorway and disappear forever. I had to go for counselling.
You're having a lost life crisis, the counsellor told me. It's like a midlife crisis, only you've lost yours.
You just have to resign yourself to being a mediocrity.
So my life without a life went on, and that could have been the end of the matter. But then, I saw it again. Oh yes, it was right there on the front of my newspaper. The Oscar for Best Actor had been won by a young British actor called Nubster Stanton, for his starring role in the blockbuster film The Man of Means. As well as starring in the film, he also directed it, composed the music, and built all the sets with his own carpentry tools. He scooped every award, apart from the leading lady one, which went to his partner, the beautiful and intelligent Turg Munk, for her portrayal of the doomed model whose career is tragically ruined when she grows an extra leg after being infected with an alien virus. It took a second for the penny to drop, but when it did, I leapt to my feet.
"My life! Nubster Stanton has got my life! Look!" I cried to Miss Peasley. "Look! Nubster Stanton, he's got my life! Don't you see? Wealth, fame, acclaim, genius, they're mine! They were all the things on the back of that lorry. It's my life, and he's stolen it!"
"And that's my life," Miss Peasley said. "Turk Munk has stolen my life. Rich, famous and beautiful. That should be me."
"I'm going to find a good lawyer," I said. And I did. He sent the following letter to Nubster Stanton on my behalf.
"Dear Mr. Stanton, my client, J. Rubichuck Plumcott, has reason to believe that you may be in receipt of a stolen life, which by right should belong to him. While we are sure you came upon this life quite unaware that it had already been spoken for, we nevertheless feel that morally it belongs to my client, who will appreciate its return at your earliest convenience. Yours sincerely, B. Spoonhandle, Solicitor."
We sent the letter to his agent, but received no reply. While we were waiting for the return of our lives, Miss Peasley and I got married and started a family. She's no Turk Munk, but in some ways, Miss Peasley is far more attractive. Whilst Turk Munk may be up there on the silver screen, Miss Peasley is right here, on the sofa. I've been waiting some years now for Nubster Stanton to do the decent thing and to return my life, because if he's got my life, I must have his. I wonder if he ever thinks about that. By rights, he should be married to Miss Peasley, not me. But I'm afraid he's disappointed me. He's not the man I thought. As our son is growing up now, I felt he was old enough to know a few things. So this morning I took him aside and told him all about the lorry and how I should be a film star. He didn't seem impressed, though. He just looked at me almost sadly and said, "Oh, Dad, get a life." He's a smart boy, though. I'll say that. I can see a great life ahead of him.
Getting a Life was written by Alex Shearer and read by Brian Parr. The producer was Pauline Stone.